Because you should. Sykes's expression softened. The lecture was over. So maybe it's the military who is picking up the check. I say let them, because frankly, what we've spent so far would make your eyes pop out. I don't know about you, but I'd like to live to meet my great-great-great-grandchildren. Hell, I'd like to hit a golf ball 300 yards on my 100th birthday and then go home to make love to my wife until she walks funny for a week. Who wouldn't? He looked at Walgast searchingly. The side of the angels, agent. Nothing more or less. Do we have a deal? They shook, and Sykes walked him to the door. Richards was waiting to take him back to the van. One last question, Walgast asked. Why Noah? What's it stand for? Sykes glanced quickly at Richards. In that moment, Walgast felt the balance of power shifting in the room. Sykes might have been technically in charge, but in some way, Walgast felt certain, he also reported to Richards, who was probably the link between the military and whoever was really running the show. U.S. AMRID, Homeland, maybe NSA. Sykes turned back to Walgast. It doesn't stand for anything. Let's put it this way. You ever read the Bible? Some. Walgast looked at the both of them. When I was a kid, my mother was a Methodist. Sykes allowed himself a second, final smile. Go look it up. The story of Noah and the Ark. See how long he lived. That's all I'll say. That night, back in his Denver apartment, Walgast did as Sykes had said. He didn't own a Bible, probably hadn't laid eyes on one since his wedding day, but he found a concordance online. And all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. It was then that he realized what the missing piece was, the thing Sykes hadn't said. It would be in his file, of course. It was the reason, of all the federal agents they might have chosen, that they'd picked him. They'd chosen him because of Eva. Because he'd had to watch his daughter die. In the morning he awoke to the chirp of his handheld. He was dreaming, and in the dream it was Lila, calling him back to tell him the baby had been born. Not hers and David's baby, but their own. For a moment Walgast felt happy, but then his mind cleared, and he realized where he was. Huntsville, the motel, and his hand found the phone on the nightstand and punched the receive button without his even looking at the screen to see who it was. He heard the static of the encryption, and then the opening line. All set, Sykes told him. Everything should be in hand. Just get Carter to sign. And don't pack your bags quite yet. We may have another errand for you to run. He looked at the clock. 6:58. Doyle was in the shower. Walgast heard the faucet shut off with a groan, then the blast of a hairdryer. He had a vague memory of hearing Doyle returning from the bar, a rush of street noise from the open door, a muttered apology, and then the sound of water running, and looking at the clock and seeing it was a little after 2 a.m. Doyle stepped into the room, a towel wrapped at his waist. Steam moistened the air around him.
Good, you're up.
His eyes were bright, his skin flushed from the heat of the shower. How the guy could stay out half the night drinking and still look like he was ready to run a marathon was beyond Walgast's comprehension. Walgast cleared his throat. How's the fiber optic business? Doyle dropped onto the opposite bed and ran a hand through his damp hair.
You'd be surprised how interesting a business that is. People underestimate it, I think.
Let me guess. The one with the pants? Doyle grinned, giving his eyebrows a playful wag. They all had pants, boss. He tipped his head at Walgast.
What happened to you?
You look like you got dragged from a car.
Walgast looked down at himself to discover he'd slept the night in his clothes. This was becoming something of a habit. Ever since he'd gotten the email from Lila, he'd spent most nights on the sofa of his apartment, watching television until he fell asleep, as if going to bed like a normal person was something he was no longer qualified to do. "Forget about it," he said. "Must have been a boring game." He rose and stretched. "We heard from Sykes. Let's get this over with." They ate breakfast at a Denny's and drove back to Polunsky. The warden was waiting for them in his office. Was it just the mood of the morning, Walgast thought, or did he look like he hadn't slept very well either? "Don't bother to sit," the warden said, and handed them an envelope. Walgast examined the contents. It was all pretty much as he expected. A writ of commutation from the governor's office and a court order transferring Carter to their custody as a federal prisoner. Assuming Carter signed, they could have him in transit to the federal lockup at El Reno by dinner. From there, he'd be moved to three other federal facilities, his trail growing fainter each time, until somewhere around 2 weeks or three or a month at most, a black van would pull into the compound, and a man now known simply as Number 12 would step out, blinking at the Colorado sunshine. The last items in the envelope were Carter's death certificate and a medical examiner's report, both dated March 23rd. On the morning of the 23rd, 3 days hence, Anthony Lloyd Carter would die in his cell from a cerebral aneurysm. Walgast returned the documents to the envelope and put it in his pocket, a chill snaking through him. How easy it was to make a human being disappear, just like that. "Thank you, Warden. We appreciate your cooperation." The warden looked at each of them in turn, his jaw set. "I'm also instructed to say I never heard of you guys." Walgast did his best to smile. "Is there a problem with that?" "I'm supposing if there were, one of those ME reports would show up with my name on it." "I've got kids, Agent." He picked up his phone and punched a number. "Have two COs bring Anthony Carter to the cages, then come to my office." He hung up and looked at Walgast. "If you don't mind, I'd like you to wait outside. I look at you any longer, I'm going to have a hard time forgetting about all this. Good day, gentlemen." 10 minutes later, a pair of guards stepped into the outer office. The older one had the benevolent, overfed look of a shopping mall Santa, but the other guard, who couldn't have been more than 20, was wearing a snarl on his face that Walgast didn't like. There was always one guard who liked the job for the wrong reasons, and this was the one. "You the guys looking for Carter?" Walgast nodded and showed his credentials. "That's right. Special Agents Walgast and Doyle." "Don't matter who you are," the heavy one said. "The warden says to take you, we'll take you." They led Walgast and Doyle down to the visiting area. Carter was sitting on the other side of the glass, the phone wedged between his ear and shoulder. He was small, just as Doyle had said, and his jumpsuit fit him loosely, like the clothing on a Ken doll. There were many ways to look condemned, Walgast had learned, and Carter's look wasn't scared or angry, but simply resigned, like the world had been taking slow bites of him his whole life. Walgast gestured at the shackles, turning toward the two COs. "Take those off, please." The older one shook his head. "That's standard." "I don't care what it is. Take them off." Walgast lifted the phone from its cradle on the wall. "Anthony Carter? I'm Special Agent Walgast. This is Special Agent Doyle. We're from the FBI. These men are going to come around and remove those shackles. I asked them to do that. You'll cooperate with them, won't you?" Carter gave a tight nod. His voice on the other end of the phone was quiet.
"Yes, sir."
"Anything else you need to make you comfortable?" Carter looked at him quizzically. How long since anybody had asked him a question like that?
"I's all right," he said.
Walgass turned to face the guards. Well, how about it? Am I talking to myself here, or am I going to have to call the warden? A moment passed as the guards looked at each other, deciding what to do. Then the one named Dennis stepped from the room and reappeared a moment later on the far side of the glass. Walgast stood and watched, keeping his eyes fixed on the guard while he removed the shackles. "That it?" said the heavy guard. "That's it. We'll want to be left alone for a while. We'll tell the OD when we're done." "Suit yourself," the guard said and walked out, closing the door behind him. There was only one chair in the room, a folding metal seat, like something from a high school auditorium. Walgast took it and positioned himself squarely to the glass, while Doyle remained standing behind him. The talking was Walgast's to do. He picked up the phone again. "Better?" Carter hesitated a moment, appraising him, then nodded.
"Yes, sir. Thank you. Pincher always does 'em too tight."
Pincher. Walgast made a mental note of this. "You hungry? They give you breakfast in there?"
"Pancakes."
Carter shrugged. "That was 5 hours ago, though." Walgast swiveled to look at Doyle, raising his eyebrows. Doyle nodded and left the room. For a few minutes, Walgast just waited. Despite the large no-smoking sign, the edge of the counter was rutted with brown burn marks.
"You said you from the FBI?"
"That's right, Anthony." A trace of a smile flicked across Carter's face.
"Like on that show?"
Walgast didn't know what Carter was talking about, but that was fine. It would give Carter something to explain. "What show's that, Anthony?"
"The one with the woman. The one with the aliens."
Walgast thought a moment, then remembered. "Of course. The X-Files. It had been off the air for, what, 20 years? Carter had probably seen it as a kid in reruns. Walgast couldn't remember very much about it, just the idea of it. Alien abductions, some kind of conspiracy to hush the thing up. That was Carter's impression of the FBI. "I liked that show, too. You getting on in here all right?" Carter squared his shoulders.
"You came here to ask me that?"
"You're a smart guy, Anthony." "No, that's not the reason."
"What the reason, then?"
Walgast leaned closer to the glass. He found Carter's eyes and held them with his own. "I know about this place, Anthony. Terrell Unit. I know what goes on in here. I'm just making sure you're being treated properly." Carter eyed him skeptically.
"Does tolerable, I guess."
"The guard's okay with you?"
"Pincher's tight with the cuffs, but he's all right most of the time."
Carter lifted his bony shoulders in a shrug.
"Dennis ain't no friend of mine. Some of the others, too."
The door opened behind Carter and Doyle entered, bearing a yellow tray from the commissary. He placed the tray on the counter in front of Carter. A cheeseburger and fries, gleaming with grease, resting on waxed paper in a little plastic basket. Beside it sat a carton of chocolate milk. "Go on, Anthony," Walgast said and gestured toward the tray. "We can talk when you're done." Carter placed the receiver on the counter and lifted the cheeseburger to his mouth. 3 bites and the thing was half gone. Carter wiped his mouth with the back of his hand and got to work on the fries while Walgast watched. Carter's concentration was total. It was like watching a dog eat, Walgast thought. Doyle had returned to Walgast's side of the glass.
"Damn," he said quietly. "That guy sure was hungry."
"They got anything for dessert down there?"
"Bunch of dried-up-looking pies. Some eclairs looked like dog turds."
Walgast thought a moment. On second thought, skip dessert. "Get him a glass of iced tea. Make it nice, too, if you can. Dress it up a little." Doyle frowned. He's got the milk. I don't know if they even have iced tea down there. It's like a barnyard.
This is Texas, Phil. Wolgast suppressed the impatience in his voice. Trust me, they have tea. Just go find it.
Doyle shrugged and left again. When Carter had finished his meal, he licked the salt off his fingers one by one and sighed deeply. When he picked up the receiver, Wolgast did the same.
How's that, Anthony? Feeling better?
Through the receiver, Wolgast could hear the watery heaviness of Carter's breathing. His eyes were slack and glazed with pleasure. All those calories, all those protein molecules, all those complex carbohydrates hitting his system like a hammer. Wolgast might just as well have given him a fifth of whiskey.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
A man's got to eat. A man can't live on pancakes. A silent moment passed. Carter licked his lips with a slow tongue. His voice, when he spoke, was almost a whisper.
What you want from me?
You've got it backward, Anthony, Wolgast said, nodding. It's me who's here to find out what I can do for you. Carter dropped his eyes to the counter, the grease-stained wreckage of his meal.
He sent you, didn't he?
Who's that, Anthony?
Woman's husband.
Carter frowned at the memory.
Mr. Wood?
He come here once. Told me he found Jesus. Wolgast remembered what Doyle had told him in the car. 2 years ago, and it was still on Carter's mind.
No, he didn't send me, Anthony. You have my word. Told him I was sorry,
Carter insisted, his voice cracking.
Told everybody. Ain't gonna say it no more.
No one's saying you have to, Anthony. I know you're sorry. That's why I came all this way to see you.
All what way?
A long way, Anthony. Wolgast nodded slowly. A very, very long way. Wolgast paused, searching Carter's face. There was something about him, different from the others. He felt the moment opening, like a door. Anthony, what would you say if I told you I could get you out of this place? Behind the glass, Carter eyed him cautiously.
How you mean?
Just like I said. Right now. Today. You could leave Terrell and never come back. Carter's eyes floated with incomprehension. The idea was too much to process.
I'd say now I know you's fooling with me.
No lie, Anthony. That's why we came all this way. You may not know it, but you're a special man. You could say you're one of a kind.
You talk about me leaving here.
Carter frowned bitterly.
Ain't make no sense. Not after all this time. Ain't got no appeal. Lawyer said so in a letter.
Not an appeal, Anthony. Better than that. Just you getting out of here. How does that sound to you?
It sound great.
Carter sat back and crossed his arms over his chest with a defiant laugh.
It sound too good to be true. This Terrell.
It always amazed Wolgast how much accepting the idea of commutation resembled the five stages of grief. Right now, Carter was in denial. The idea was just too much to take in. I know where you are. I know this place. It's the death house, Anthony. It's not the place where you belong. That's why I'm here. And not for just anyone. Not these other men. For you, Anthony. Carter's posture relaxed.
I ain't nobody special. I knows that.
But you are. You may not know it, but you are. You see, I need a favor from you, Anthony. This deal's a two-way street. I can get you out of here, but there's something I need for you to do for me in return.
A favor?
The people I work for, Anthony. They saw what was going to happen to you in here. They know what's going to happen in June, and they don't think it's right. They don't think it's right the way you've been treated, that your lawyer has up and left you here like this. And they realized they could do something about it, and that they had a job they needed you to do instead. Carter frowned in confusion.
Cutting, you mean? Like that lady's lawn?
Jesus, Walgast thought. He actually thought he wanted him to cut the grass. No, Anthony. Nothing like that. Something much more important. Walgast lowered his voice again.
You see, that's the thing.
What I need you to do is so important, I can't tell you what it is. Because I don't even know myself.
How you know it's so important you don't know what it is?
You're a smart man, Anthony, and you're right to ask that. But you're going to have to trust me. I can get you out of here right now. All you have to do is say you want to. That was when Walgast pulled the warden's envelope from his pocket and opened it. He always felt like a magician at this moment, lifting his hat to show a rabbit. With his free hand, he flattened the document against the glass for Carter to see. Do you know what this is? This is a writ of commutation, Anthony, signed by Governor Jenna Bush. It's dated today, right there at the bottom. You know what that means? A commutation? Carter was squinting at the paper.
I don't go to the needle?
That's right, Anthony. Not in June. Not ever. Walgast returned the paper to his jacket pocket. Now it was bait. Something to want. The other document, the one Carter would have to sign, which he would sign, Walgast felt certain, when all the hemming and hawing was over, the one in which Anthony Lloyd Carter, Texas inmate 999642, handed 100% of his earthly person, past, present, and future, to Project Noah, was tucked against it. By the time this second piece of paper saw daylight, the whole point was not to read it. Carter gave a slow nod.
Always liked her. Liked her when she was first lady.
Walgast let the error pass. She's just one of the people I work for, Anthony. There are others. You might recognize some of the names if I told you, but I can't. And they asked me to come and see you and tell you how much they need you.
So I do this thing for you, and you get me out. But you can't tell me what it is.
That's pretty much the deal, Anthony. Say no, and I'll move on. Say yes, and you can leave Terrell tonight. It's that simple. The door into the cage opened once more. Doyle stepped through, holding the tea. He'd done as Walgast had asked, balancing the glass on a saucer with a long spoon beside it and a wedge of lemon and packets of sugar. He placed it all on the counter in front of Carter. Carter looked at the glass, his face gone slack. That was when Walgast thought it. Anthony Carter wasn't guilty, at least not in the way the court had spun it. With the others, it was always clear right off what Walgast was dealing with, that the story was the story. But not in this case. Something had happened that day in the yard. The woman had died. But there was more to it. Maybe a lot more. Looking at Carter, this was the space into which Walgast felt his mind moving, like a dark room with no windows and one locked door. This, he knew, was the place where he would find Anthony Carter. He'd find him in the dark. And when he did, Carter would show him the key that would open the door. He spoke with his eyes locked on the glass.
"I just won't,"
he began. Wolgast waited for him to finish. When he didn't, Wolgast spoke again. "What do you want, Anthony? Tell me." Carter lifted his free hand to the side of the glass and brushed the tips of his fingers against it. The glass was cool and sweating with moisture. Carter drew his hand away and rubbed the beads of water between his thumb and fingers slowly, his eyes focused on this gesture with complete attention. So intense was his concentration that Wolgast could feel the man's whole mind opening up to it, taking it in. It was as if the sensation of cool water on his fingertips was the key to every mystery of his life. He raised his eyes to Wolgast's.
"I need the time to figure it," he said softly. "The thing that happened with the lady."
And all the days of Noah were 950 years. "I can give you that time, Anthony," Wolgast said. "All the time in the world. An ocean of time." Another moment passed. Then Carter nodded.
"What I got to do?"
Wolgast and Doyle got to George Bush Intercontinental a little after 7. The traffic was murderous, but they still arrived with 90 minutes to spare. They dumped the rental and rode the shuttle to the Continental Terminal, showed their credentials to bypass security, and made their way through the crowds to the gate at the far end of the concourse. Doyle excused himself to find something to eat. Wolgast wasn't hungry, though he knew he'd probably regret this decision later on, especially if their flight got hung up. He checked his handheld. Still nothing from Sykes. He was glad. All he wanted to do was get the hell out of Texas. Just a few other passengers were waiting at the gate. A couple of families, some students plugged into Blu-rays or iPods, a handful of men in suits talking on cell phones or tapping on laptops. Wolgast checked his watch. 7:25. By now, he thought, Anthony Carter would be in the back of a van well on his way to El Reno, leaving in his wake a flurry of shredded records and a fading memory that he had ever existed at all. By the end of the day, even his federal ID number would be purged. The man named Anthony Carter would be nothing but a rumor, a vague disturbance no bigger than a ripple on the surface of the world. Wolgast leaned back in his chair and realized how exhausted he was. It always came upon him like this, like the sudden unclenching of a fist. These trips left him physically and emotionally hollowed out, and with a nagging conscience he always had to apply some effort to squash. He was just too damn good at this, too good at finding the one gesture, the one right thing to say. A man sat in a concrete box long enough, thinking about his own death, and he boiled down to milky dust like water in a teapot forgotten on a stove. To understand him, you had to figure out what that dust was made of, what was left of him after the rest of his life, past and future, had turned to vapor. Usually it was something simple. Anger, or sadness, or shame, or simply the need for forgiveness. A few wanted nothing at all. All that remained was a dumb animal rage at the world and all its systems. Anthony was different. It had taken Wolgast a while to figure this out. Anthony was like a human question mark, a living, breathing expression of pure puzzlement. He actually didn't know why he was in Terrell. Not that he didn't understand his sentence, that was clear, and he had accepted it, as nearly all of them did, because they had to. All you had to do was read the last words of condemned men to know that. "Tell everyone I love them. I'm sorry. Okay, warden, let's do this." Always words to that effect, and chilling to read, as Wolgast had done by the pageful. But some piece of the puzzle was still missing for Anthony Carter. Walgast had seen it when Carter touched the side of the glass. Before then, even, when he'd asked about Rachel Wood's husband and said he was sorry without saying it. Whether Carter couldn't remember what had happened that day in the Woods yard or couldn't make his actions add up to the man he thought he was, Walgast couldn't be certain. Either way, Anthony Carter needed to find this piece of himself before he died. From his seat, Walgast had a good view of the airfield through the terminal windows. The sun was going down, its last rays angling sharply off the fuselages of parked aircraft. The flight home always did him good. A few hours in the air, chasing the sunset, and he'd feel like himself again. He never drank or read or slept, just sat perfectly still, breathing the plane's bottled air and fixing his eyes out the window as the ground below him slipped into darkness. Once, on a flight back from Tallahassee, Walgast's plane had flown around a storm front so huge it looked like an airborne mountain range, its roiling interior lit like a creche with jags of lightning. A night in September. They were somewhere over Oklahoma, he thought, or Kansas, someplace flat and empty. It could have been farther west. The cabin was dark. Nearly everyone on the plane was sleeping, including Doyle, seated beside him with a pillow tucked against his stubbled cheek. For 20 full minutes the plane had ridden the edge of the storm without so much as a jostle. In all his life, Walgast had never seen anything like it, had never felt himself so completely in the presence of nature's immensity, its planet-sized power. The air inside the storm was a cataclysm of pure atmospheric voltage, yet here he was, sealed in silence, hurtling along with nothing but 30,000 feet of empty air below him, watching it all as if it were a movie on a screen, a movie without sound. He waited for the pilot's drawling voice to crackle over the intercom and say something about the weather, to let the other passengers in on the show. But this never happened. And when they landed in Denver, 40 minutes late, Walgast never mentioned it. Not even to Doyle. He thought now that he'd like to call Lila and tell her about it. The feeling was so strong, so clear in his mind that it took a moment for him to realize how crazy this was, that it was just the time machine talking. The time machine. That's the name the counselor had given it. She was a friend of Lila's from the hospital whom they had visited just a couple of times, a woman in her 30s with long hair, prematurely gray, and large eyes, permanently damp with sympathy. She liked to take her shoes off at the start of each visit and sit with her legs folded under her, like a camp counselor about to lead them in song, and she spoke so quietly that Walgast had to lean forward from the sofa to hear her. From time to time, she explained in her tiny voice, their minds would play tricks on them. It wasn't a warning, the way she said it. She was simply stating a fact. He and Lila might do something or see something and have a strong feeling from the past. They might, for instance, find themselves standing in the checkout line of the grocery with a packet of diapers in their cart, or tiptoeing past Eva's room as if she were asleep. Those would be the hardest moments, the woman explained, because they'd have to relive their loss all over again. But as the months passed, she assured them, this would happen less and less. The thing was, these moments weren't hard for Walgast. They still happened to him every now and then, even 3 years after the fact. And when they did, he didn't mind at all. Far from it. They were unexpected presents his mind could give him. But it was different for Lila, he knew. Agent Walgast. He turned in his chair. The simple gray suit, the inexpensive but comfortable Oxford shoes, the blandly forgettable tie. Walgast might have been looking in a mirror, but the face was new to him. He rose and reached into his pocket to show his ID. That's me. Special Agent Williams, Houston Field Office. They shook. I'm afraid you won't be taking this flight after all. I've got a car outside for you. Is there a message? Williams drew an envelope from his pocket. I think this is probably what you're looking for.
Walgast accepted the envelope. Inside was a fax. He sat and read, then read it again. He was still reading when Doyle returned, sipping from a straw and carrying a bag from Taco Bell. Walgast lifted his gaze to Williams.
Give us a second, will you?
Williams moved off down the concourse.
What is it?
Doyle said quietly. What's wrong? Walgast shook his head. He passed the fax to Doyle.
Sweet Jesus, Phil. It's a civilian.
Chapter 4 Sister Lacey Antoinette Cudotto didn't know what God wanted, but she knew he wanted something. As long as she could remember, the world had spoken to her like this, in whispers and murmurs, in the rustling of the palm fronds moving in the ocean wind above the village where she was raised, in the sound of cool water running over rocks in the stream behind her house, even in the busy sounds men made, in the engines and machines and voices of the human world. She was just a little girl, not more than 6 or 7, when she'd asked Sister Margaret, who ran the convent school in Port Loco, what she was hearing, and Sister laughed.
Lacey Antoinette, she said. How you surprise me. Don't you know?
She lowered her voice, putting her face close to Lacey's.
That's nothing less than the voice of God.
But she did know. She understood, as soon as Sister said it, that she'd always known. She never told anyone else about the voice, the way Sister had spoken to her, as if it was something only the two of them knew, told her that what she heard in the wind and leaves, in the very thread of existence itself, was a private thing between them. There were times, sometimes for weeks or even a month, when the feeling receded and the world became an ordinary place again, made of ordinary things. She believed that this was how the world felt to most people, even those closest to her, her parents and sisters and friends at school. They lived their whole lives in a prison of drab silence, a world without a voice. Knowing this made her so sad that sometimes she couldn't stop crying for days at a time, and her parents would take her to the doctor, a Frenchman with long sideburns who sucked on candies that smelled like camphor, who poked and peeked and touched her up and down with the ice-cold disc of his stethoscope, but never found anything wrong.
How terrible, she thought. How terrible to live like this, all alone forever.
But then one day she'd be walking to school through the cocoa fields, or eating dinner with her sisters, or doing nothing at all, just looking at a stone on the ground, or lying awake in bed, and she'd hear it again. The voice that wasn't a voice exactly, that came from inside her and also from everywhere around, a hushed whisper that seemed not made of sound, but light itself, that moved through as gently as a breeze on water. By the time she was 18 and entered the sisters, she knew what it was, that it was calling her name.
Lacey, the world said to her. Lacey, listen.
She heard it now, all these years later and an ocean away, sitting in the kitchen of the convent of the Sisters of Mercy in Memphis, Tennessee. She'd found the note in the girl's backpack not long after her mother had left. Something about the circumstances had made Lacey uneasy, and looking at the girl she realized what it was. The woman had never told her the girl's name. The girl was obviously her daughter, the same dark hair, the same pale skin and long lashes that curled upward at the ends as if lifted by a tiny breeze. She was pretty, but her hair needed combing. There were mats in it thick as a dog's, and she had kept her jacket on the table as if she were used to leaving places in a hurry. She seemed healthy, if a little thin. Her pants were too short and stiff with dirt. When the little girl had finished her snack, every bite, Lacey took the chair beside her. She asked her if she had anything in the bag she wanted to play with, or a book they could read together. But the little girl, who hadn't spoken a word, just nodded and passed it from her lap.
Lacey examined the bag, pink with some kind of cartoon characters glued on. Their huge black eyes reminded her of the girls, and remembered what the woman had told her, that she was taking her daughter to school. She unzipped the bag and inside found the stuffed rabbit, and the pairs of rolled-up underpants and socks and a toothbrush in a case, and a box of strawberry cereal bars half-empty. There was nothing else in the bag, but then she noticed the little zippered pouch on the outside. It was too late for school, Lacey realized. The girl had no lunch, no books. She held her breath and unzipped the pouch. There she found the piece of notebook paper, folded up. "I'm sorry. Her name is Amy. She's 6 years old." Lacey looked at it for a long time. Not the words themselves, which were plain enough in their meaning. What she looked at was the space around the words. A whole page of nothing at all. 3 tiny sentences were all this girl had in the world to explain who she was. Just 3 sentences and the few little things in the bag. It was nearly the saddest thing Lacey Antoinette Kudoto had ever seen in her life. So sad, she couldn't even cry. There was no point in going after the woman. She'd be long gone by now. And what would Lacey do if she found her? What could she say? "I think you forgot something. I think you've made some mistake." But there was no mistake. The woman, Lacey understood, had done exactly what she'd set out to do. She folded the note and put it in the deep pocket of her skirt. "Amy," she said, and as Sister Margaret had done all those years ago in the yard at the school in Port Loko, she positioned her face close to the girl's. She smiled. "Is that your name, Amy? That's a beautiful name." The girl looked around the room quickly, almost furtively. "Can I have Peter?" Lacey thought a moment. "A brother? The little girl's father?" "Of course," she said. "Who is Peter, Amy?" "He's in the bag," the girl stated. Lacey was relieved. The girl's first request of her was something simple that she could easily provide. She removed the rabbit from the bag. It was velveteen plush, worn smooth in shiny patches, a little boy rabbit with beady black eyes and ears stiffened by wire. Lacey passed it to Amy, who placed it roughly on her lap.
"Amy," she began again, "where did your mother go?"
"I don't know," she said.
"How about Peter?" Lacey asked. "Does Peter know? Could Peter tell me?"
"He doesn't know anything," Amy said. "He's stuffed." The little girl frowned sharply.
"I want to go back to the motel."
"Tell me," Lacey said. "Where is the motel, Amy?"
"I'm not supposed to say."
"Is it a secret?" The girl nodded, her eyes fixed on the surface of the table. A secret so deep she couldn't even say it was a secret, Lacey thought.
"I can't take you there if I don't know where it is, Amy. Is that what you want? To go to the motel?"
"It's on the busy road," the girl explained, tugging at her sleeve.
"You live there with your mother?"
Amy said nothing. She had a way of neither looking nor speaking, of being alone with herself even in the presence of another person that Lacey had never encountered. There was something even a little frightening about it. When the girl did this, it was as if she, Lacey, were the one who had vanished.
"I have an idea," Lacey declared. "Would you like to play a game, Amy?"
The girl eyed her skeptically.
"What kind?" "I call it secrets. It's easy to play. I tell you a secret, and then you tell me one. Do you see? A trade. My secret for your secret. How does that sound?"
The girl shrugged.
"Okay. All right, then. I'll start. Here is my secret. One time, when I was very young, like you, I ran away from home. This was in Sierra Leone, where I come from. I was very cross at my mother, because she wouldn't let me go to see a carnival without doing my lessons first. I was very excited about this carnival, because I had heard they did tricks with horses, and I was crazy about horses. I bet you like horses too, don't you, Amy? The girl nodded. I guess. Every girl likes horses. But me, I was in love with them. To show her how mad I was, I refused to do my lessons, and she sent me to my room for the night. Oh, I was so angry. I stamped around the room like a crazy person. Then I thought, if I run away, she'll be sorry she has treated me this way. She'll let me do what I like from now on. I was very foolish, but that is what I believed. So that night, after my parents and my sisters were asleep, I left the house. I didn't know where to go, so I hid in the fields behind our yard. It was cold and very dark. I wanted to stay there all night, and then in the morning I would be able to hear my mother crying my name when she woke up and found I wasn't there. But I couldn't do this. I stayed in the field a little while, but eventually I was too cold and frightened. I went back home and got into bed, and nobody ever knew I was gone. She looked at the girl, who was watching her closely, and did her best to smile. There. I've never told anyone that story. Not until now. You are the first person I've told in my life. What do you think of that? The girl was watching Lacey attentively now. You just went home? Lacey nodded. You see, I wasn't so angry anymore. And in the morning, it all seemed like a dream I'd had. I wasn't even sure it had actually happened, though now, many years later, I know that it did. She patted Amy's hand encouragingly. Now, it is your turn. Do you have a secret to tell me, Amy? The girl lowered her face and said nothing. Even a little one? I don't think she's coming back, said Amy. The police officers who took the call, a man and a woman, got nowhere either. The female officer, a heavy-set white woman with a cropped haircut like a man's, spoke to the girl in the kitchen, while the other officer, a handsome black man with a smooth, narrow face, took a description of the mother from Lacey. Did she seem nervous? He asked her. Was she drunk, on drugs? What was she wearing? Did Lacey see the car? On and on he went, but Lacey could tell he was asking only because he had to. He didn't think the girl's mother would turn up either. He recorded her answers with a tiny pencil on a pad of paper that, as soon as she'd finished, he returned to the breast pocket of his uniform. In the kitchen, a flash of light. The woman officer had taken Amy's picture. "Do you want to call child protection, or should we do it?" the policeman asked Lacey. "Because, seeing as how you are who you are, it might make sense if we waited. No use putting her into the system right away, especially over the weekend, if you don't mind keeping her here. We can put out a description of the woman and see if we get anywhere. We'll also put the girl in the missing child database. The mother might come back, too. Though if she does, you should keep the girl here and call us." It was a little past noon. The other sisters were all due back at 1 o'clock from the community pantry, where they'd passed the morning stocking shelves and dispensing boxes of canned goods and cereal, spaghetti sauce and diapers. They did this every Tuesday and Friday. But Lacey had been nursing a head cold all week. Even after 3 years in Memphis, she still hadn't adapted to the damp winters, and Sister Arnett had told Lacey to stay home, no use making herself sicker.
It was like Sister Arnett to make a decision like this, even though Lacey had woken up feeling perfectly well. Looking at the officer, she made a quick decision.
"I will do it," she said.
Which was how, when the sisters returned, it happened that Lacey failed to tell them the truth about the girl.
"This is Amy,"
she told them, as they were taking off their coats and scarves in the hall.
"Her mother is a friend, and she was called away to visit a sick relative, and Amy will be spending the weekend with us."
It surprised her how easily the lie came. She had no practice with deceit, and yet the words had assembled themselves quickly in her mind and found their way to her lips without effort. As she spoke, she glanced at Amy, wondering if she would expose her, and she saw a flicker of agreement in the girl's eyes. She was, Lacey understood then, a girl used to keeping secrets. "Sister," said Sister Arnett, speaking with her old woman's air of perpetual disapproval, "I'm glad to see that you are offering our help to this girl and her mother. But it is also true that this is something you should have asked me about."
"I'm very sorry," Lacey said. "It was an emergency. It will only be until Monday."
Sister Arnett looked appraisingly at Lacey, then down at Amy, who was standing with her back pressed to the pleats of Lacey's skirt. While she did this, Sister Arnett removed her gloves, one finger at a time. Cold air from outside still swirled in the close space of the hallway. "This is a convent, not an orphanage. This isn't a place for children."
"I understand, Sister, and I am very sorry. It simply couldn't be helped."
Another moment passed.
"Dear Lord," Lacey thought, "help me to like this person more than I do, Sister Arnett, who is imperious and thinks much of herself, but is your servant as I am."
"All right," Sister Arnett said at last and sighed irritably. "Until Monday. She can use the spare room." It was then that Sister Lacey wondered why. Why she had lied, and why the lie had come so easily, as if it weren't a lie in the larger sense of things true and things untrue. Her story was also full of holes. What would happen if the police returned, or telephoned, and Sister Arnett discovered what she'd done? What would happen Monday when she had to call the county? And yet she felt no fear about these matters. The girl was a mystery, sent to them by God. And not even to them, but to her. To Lacey. It was her job to figure out what the answer to this mystery was, and by lying to Sister Arnett. Not necessarily a lie, she told herself. Who was to say the mother hadn't gone to visit a sick relative after all? She had given herself the time required to unravel it. So perhaps that was why the lie had come so easily. The Holy Spirit had spoken through her, inspired her with the flame of a different, deeper sort of truth. And what it had said was that the girl was in trouble and needed Lacey to help her. The other sisters were pleased. They never had visitors, or at least very rarely, and these were always religious. Priests, other sisters. But a little girl? This was something new. The minute Sister Arnett had climbed the stairs to her room, they all began to talk. How did Sister Lacey know the girl's mother? How old was Amy? What did she like to do, to eat, to watch, to wear? They were so excited they scarcely noticed how seldom Amy spoke, that in fact she said nothing at all. Lacey did the talking. For dinner, Amy would like hamburgers and hot dogs. These were her favorites, with potato chips and chocolate chip ice cream. She enjoyed coloring and crafts, and liked to watch movies with princesses in them, and rabbits, if they had anything like that at the store. She would need clothes. Her mother, in her haste, had forgotten the little girl's suitcase. She was so frazzled by her own mission of mercy. To Arkansas, near Little Rock, the little girl's grandmother was diabetic, with heart trouble. And when she'd said she would go home for it, Lacey had insisted no, she could easily manage. The lies poured forth so gracefully upon ears so willing to believe that
Within the hour, all the sisters seemed to have a slightly different version of the same story. Sister Louisa and Sister Claire took the van to Piggly Wiggly for the hamburgers and hot dogs and chips, then to Walmart for clothing and movies and toys. In the kitchen, Sister Tracy set about planning the evening meal, announcing that not only could they expect the promised hamburgers and hot dogs and ice cream, but to go with the ice cream, a 3-tier chocolate cake. They always looked forward to Fridays, Sister Tracy's night to cook. Her parents owned a restaurant in Chicago. Before she'd entered the sisters, she had trained at Cordon Bleu. Even Sister Arnette seemed to catch the spirit, sitting with Amy and the other sisters in the den to watch the Princess Bride while dinner was prepared. Through it all, Sister Lacey set her mind on God. When the movie, which everyone agreed was wonderful, ended, and Sister Louise and Sister Claire took Amy to the kitchen to show her some of the toys they'd bought at Walmart, coloring books, crayons, and paste and construction paper, a Barbie pet shop kit that had taken Sister Louise 15 minutes to free from the prison of its plastic package with all of its little parts, the combs and brushes for the dogs and the tiny dishes and the rest. Lacey climbed the stairs. In the silence of her room, she prayed on this mystery, the mystery of Amy, listening for the voice that would sweep through her, filling her with the knowledge of his will. But as she lifted her mind to God, all that came to her was the feeling of a question with no certain answer. This, she knew, was another way God could speak to a person. His will was elusive most of the time, and although this was frustrating, and it would be nice if from time to time he chose to make his intentions more explicit, this wasn't how things worked. Though most of the sisters prayed in the little chapel behind the kitchen, and Lacey did this too, she reserved her most earnest, searching prayers for this time alone in her room, not even kneeling, but sitting at her desk or on the corner of her narrow bed. She'd put her hands in her lap, close her eyes, and send her mind out as far as she could. Since childhood, she had imagined it as a kite on a string, lifting higher as she let the line out, and wait to see what happened. Now, sitting on the bed, she sent the kite as high as she dared, the imaginary ball of string growing smaller in her hand, the kite itself just a speck of color far above her head. But all she felt was the wind of heaven pushing upon it, a force of great power against a thing so small. After dinner, the sisters returned to the living room to watch a program on TV, a hospital show they had been following all year, and Sister Lacey took Amy upstairs to prepare for bed. It was 8 o'clock. Usually all the sisters were in bed by 9, to rise at 5 for morning devotions, and it seemed to Lacey that these were the kind of hours a girl of Amy's age could also keep. She gave Amy a bath, scrubbing her hair with raspberry shampoo and working in a dollop of conditioner for the tangles, then combing it all out so it was straight and glossy, its rich black hue deepening with each pull of the comb, before taking her old clothing downstairs to the laundry. By the time she returned, Amy had put on the pajamas Sister Claire had bought that afternoon at Walmart. They were pink, with a pattern of stars and moons with smiling faces, and made of a material that rustled and shone like silk. When Lacey entered the room, she saw that Amy was looking at the sleeves with a bewildered expression. They were too long, flopping clownishly over her hands and feet. Lacey rolled them up. While she watched, Amy brushed her teeth and put her toothbrush back in its case, and then turned from the mirror to face her. "Do I sleep in here?" So many hours had passed since she'd heard the girl's voice that Lacey wasn't sure she'd heard the question correctly. She searched the little girl's face. The question, strange as it was, made sense to her. "Why would you sleep in the bathroom, Amy?" She looked at the floor. "Mama says I have to be quiet." Lacey didn't know what to make of this. "No. Of course not. You'll sleep in your room. It's right next to mine. I'll show you." The room was clean and spare, bare-walled, with just a bed and a bureau and a small writing table, not even a rug on the floor to warm it. and Lacey wished she had something to make it nice for a little girl. She thought that tomorrow she would ask Sister Arnett if she could buy a small rug to put by the bed so Amy's feet wouldn't have to touch the cold floorboards in the mornings. She tucked Amy under the blankets and sat on the edge of the mattress. Through the floor she could hear the faint rumble of the television downstairs and the tick of pipes expanding behind the walls, and outside the wind fingering the March leaves of the oaks and maples and the soft hum of evening traffic on Poplar Avenue. The zoo was 2 blocks behind the convent, at the far end of the park. On summer nights when the windows were open, they could sometimes hear the colobus monkeys whooping and screeching in their cages. This was a strange and wonderful thing for Lacey to hear, so many thousands of miles from home. But when she had visited the zoo, she'd discovered it was an awful place, like a jail. The pens were small, the cats were kept in barren cages behind walls of plexiglass, the elephants and giraffes wore chains on their legs. All the animals looked depressed. Most could barely be bothered to move at all, and the people who came to see them were loud and boorish and let their children throw popcorn through the bars to make the animals notice them. It was more than Lacey could bear, and she had left quickly, close to tears. It broke her heart to see God's creatures treated so cruelly, with such cold-hearted indifference, for no purpose. But now, sitting on the edge of the bed, she thought that it might be something Amy would like. Perhaps she'd never been to a zoo at all. As long as there was nothing Lacey could do to ease the animals' suffering, it didn't seem sinful, a second wrong piled on top of the first, to bring a little girl who had so little happiness in her life to see them. She would ask Sister Arnett in the morning about this, when she asked about the rug. "There now," she said, and adjusted Amy's blanket. The girl was lying very still, almost as if she were afraid to move. "All safe and sound. And I'm just next door if you need anything. Tomorrow we'll do something fun, you'll see. The two of us." "Can you leave the light on?" Lacey told her she would. Then she leaned over and kissed her on the forehead. The air around her smelled like jam from the shampoo. "I like your sisters," Amy said. Lacey felt herself smiling. With everything that had happened, she had somehow failed to anticipate this misunderstanding.
"Yes. Well, it's difficult to explain. You see, we are not actual sisters, not how you mean. We do not have the same parents, but we are sisters nonetheless."
"But how can you be?"
"Oh, there.